host, Dmitry Filipovich.
Welcome to the Hockey PDOcast. My name is Dmitry Filipovich, and joining me is my good buddy John Mattis. John, what's going on, man?
Not a whole lot. Just coming off a pretty eventful weekend as far as playoff hockey, and plenty to talk about, plenty of controversy. Let's get after it.
Let's get after it, indeed. It was a fun weekend of playoff hockey. Lots happened, and we're going to catch up on all of it here over the next hour or so. Let's try to cover all four series, at least to some extent, right? Obviously, we're recording this on Monday. There's another fresh batch of games tonight, which is the beauty of the playoffs. And actually, I really enjoy that. It kind of complicates it from like the content perspective, right? When you're doing these shows and there's such like a finite period of time for people to listen. At the same time, though, the beautiful part is like every new night, it's a new slate, fresh start, and you kind of get back over again. So we'll do Bruins Panthers here to start because we saw that on Sunday. It's still fresh on the mind. There's a lot going on in that series. Certainly, we're going to talk about Sam Bennett, both the sucker punch on Brad Marchand, and also the controversial goaltender interference goal that tied that game up in game four. But we're at this point now where the Panthers, you know, they lost that game one after a long time off. And since then, they've really righted the ship. They've won three in a row here. They've got the Bruins on the brink. What are your kind of takeaways from what we've seen recently in this series in terms of how it's played out and what like the most sort of decisive factors, I guess, have been for you?
Sure. I think the first thing that jumps off the page, and this relates to Bennett to some extent, is that Boston's kind of trying to beat Florida at their own game. And by that, I mean being chaotic, you know, pulling the other team into the fight. And it's just not working. I mean, you see Maroon trying to get under Bennett's skin in game four penalty. You see Pasternak sucker punch Lundell after a whistle. Maybe a bit of an embellishment from Lundell, but nevertheless, penalty. Like, I get where Boston's coming from as far as it's emotional. The whole Marchand-Bennett situation with the sucker punch, that's, you know, going to set off alarm bells and get you fired up. But, like, you got to just play. You got to let those things go. It's not a regular season game. Every single inch, every single moment, power play opportunity is super important here. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing I would say is that, and this is kind of weird because now Florida's up 3-1, but as the series progressed, one thing I've noticed is that Boston's done a really good job of causing turnovers in Florida's zone. And you know what? It kind of goes back to game one as well, but especially in game four, I found that Florida was trying to really force breakouts through the middle of the ice, and Boston kept disrupting that. And it turned into some offense for Boston. And, you know, ultimately they don't get the victory, but they were up 2-0 for whatever it was, 35 minutes of the game or something like that. So, you know, something to keep in mind, I guess, a little silver lining if you're a Bruins fan, where I felt like they really identified Florida's breakout and decision-making on the wall and exploited it. So I don't know if that's something where the Panthers just, you know, over the next day or next game or two, depending on how long this goes, decide when they're on the wall there, you know, we're just not going up the middle unless it's absolutely a perfect scenario. And we're going to, you know, clear the zone in other ways, off the wall or you know, eat it maybe even on the wall. So those are two things that jumped off the page for me.
Well, tying into that, here's the scoring chance count by game in this series. Game one, 21-19 for Florida, and the Bruins actually for a large chunk of that were getting the better of the play, and then they built up that lead, right? And then we saw Florida kind of give one last push in the third period and kind of skewed that a little bit. Game two, 23-10 for Florida. They absolutely just ran them off the ice. Game three, 17-8. Now, they were 13-1 at the point that the Panthers made it 4-0 in the third. The Bruins had one scoring chance in the first 45 minutes or so of that game. Game four, 26-14 for Florida. So for those scoring at home, last three games, it's 67-32 are the scoring chances by my count. And the reason why I bring that up, it kind of ties into your point about the breakouts. Game one, I thought Aaron Ekblad was catastrophically bad. Like, he just kept making mistakes with the puck and kind of throwing it up the middle of the ice, turning it over, and the Bruins generated a lot of their offense that way. In game two, they start off with that 1-0 lead, right, where I think Charlie Coyle made a really nice play off of the forecheck, and they scored a tap-in goal off of that. And pretty much since that point in time, the Bruins just have not created any offense whatsoever. Like, they scored a couple goals and gave a little bit of a sort of half-hearted push near the end of game three to make it 4-2. And DeBrusk even had a chance to make it 4-3 at one point. But for the most part, their lack of offensive juice, I think, has really been exposed. Now, Florida was one of the best defensive teams in the league this season, right? And really kind of made their identity around that. And the genesis, or kind of the center point of all this for me, is in these last three games where Boston's really struggled, the most common matchup, as we would have predicted, has been David Pastrnak's line versus Gus Forsling and Aaron Ekblad. There's been 23 5-on-5 minutes head-to-head in that time. The shots are 14-2 for Florida, and Boston's generated 0.15 total expected goals in that time, 0.15, with David Pastrnak on the ice. Now, he has two scoring chances in those three games. Both were on the power play, and he scored on one of them in game four. Part of this, and you know, you're going to harp on it because I think he was one of the five or six best players in the league this year, right? The past 2 years, he's really taken his game to a true superstar level where he's one of the most dominant offensive players in the league. So he's going to be held to that standard. Certainly, you have to apply the context of, like, there's just so little offensive supporting talent around him. And I think in this series, that's been really exposed. It kind of was in round one as well when we talked about his struggles. But in this series, it's like playing with, you know, Geeky and Pavel Zacha, who's really struggled. They put DeBrusk there in game four. There's just so little talent around him to get him the puck and afford him opportunities to play off of it and then wind up open in the offensive zone and actually get a scoring chance. So that's certainly part of it. But Florida's done a masterful job, similar to what they did to Nikita Kucherov in round one, of really just taking away his preferred sort of outlets for creating chances, and he's gotten nothing. And when you take that away, it's like, all right, Boston just isn't really going to score beyond kind of point shots by Brandon Carlo going in. Like, they have no real actual chance of scoring. And that's been the story of the series for me.
Well, Marchand didn't play game four, right? So their second best offensive weapon is just non-existent there. And things get, we talked about this last time when I came on and we were talking Toronto, but Boston, like, things get real dicey as far as high end skill and Boston's forward group after Pastrnak and then after Marchand. And just to jump on the Pastrnak bandwagon there, I just looked it up before we came on. 11 postseason games so far, 14 high danger attempts. That's all he's got. Like, and, you know, high danger doesn't necessarily mean, you know, best looks. You know, we talk about it all the time on the show about expected goals models publicly not being great. But that tells you where he's shooting from. He's not getting to the slot at all. This was a problem against Toronto. It continues to be a problem against Florida. And I should mention those are 5-on-5 high danger attempts. He's obviously found some success on the power play, but it's a huge storyline. Pasta versus Barkov / Forsling and the other line mates there. I thought coming in the series, that was a pretty obvious matchup to focus on. And it's really borne out to be true. And, you know, similar to the other East series, I feel like 3-1 is almost selling this series short because it's been a bit weird in terms of penalties, in terms of, like, you know, the games at times have been close, at times have been below. It's like, I feel like it could have easily been 2-2, even though, as you noted, Florida's got this real stranglehold on scoring chances. But Swayman's been so good, and obviously special teams always kind of throws things off and can have a game go to one team, and next thing you know, it's 3-1. So pretty interesting series from that perspective, where when it boils down to it, I think the Bruins' lack of skill and game-breaking ability up front is really hurting them.
Well, to your note on that, I generally prefer the high danger attempts to the raw scoring chance numbers on Natural Stat Trick. I just find they're much more reflective of, like, what you would conventionally describe as a scoring chance, right? They're just so, not to keep belaboring this point, but they're just so busted this postseason. Like, I completely agree with your point about Pastrnak having a very suppressed total relative to his standards. Just as an example, is because I was thinking about it during the weekend. Will Cooley scored a really nice breakaway goal in game four of his series against Carolina, right? Kapokako makes his play along the wall, hits him with a stretch pass. Cooley goes in alone, scores. That did not register as a high danger chance. I'm pretty sure it was a pretty high danger opportunity for him, I'd say, on a one-on-one breakaway against the goalie. But they pretty much just, like, almost randomly seem to prioritize, like, anything that's a wraparound, a rebound, or a tip is the most dangerous play in hockey, apparently. And then actual rush shots like that are like, eh, I don't know. And so I think that's certainly got blind spots in terms of the category types it seems to prefer. But yeah, I'm with you on all of that. And it's tricky, right? Because I think the officiating this postseason, acknowledging that it's a really difficult job, right? Like, especially in the postseason, there's so much going on. I think we're all in agreement that I much prefer them actually calling the rules as they do all season, right? Because they exist for a reason. You're kind of conditioned to play a certain way. And then in trying to call fewer things in the pursuit of not influencing the outcome of games, that's exactly what they wind up doing, right? Because it's going to benefit one team most likely than another on who's committing the infractions and getting away with it, right? That's going to obscure what's happening in the game. At the same time, if they're calling everything, that really bogs down the game as well, right? Like, I think we've seen a bunch of games this postseason where they're calling everything, and the idea of power plays and more goals that way is fun. But then you actually watch it and you're reminded that 5-on-5 hockey is the best version of hockey, and I just want to see no whistles and them just playing back and forth, right? So it's tricky in that sense. In a game like game four, for example, obviously the Bruins are up 2-1. Jeremy Swayman's unable to make a play on the rebound. I think by the letter of the law, it's undoubtedly goaltender interference, right? His own teammate gets pushed into him. He cannot make a play on the puck, even if you think he wouldn't have been able to stop that rebound. That's kind of irrelevant to the argument because we just see that for all the talk about how, like, oh, you might as well flip a coin on goaltender interference calls. I think they made it pretty clear the past couple of years that if you're in your crease as a goalie and you can't play the puck, that's generally going to be viewed as goaltender interference, right? And that's kind of what happened on that play. The thing is Florida was just dominating all game. Like, despite the scoreline, they had the puck the entire time. They were creating everything. And I'm a big believer in creating your own fortune in that sense as well, right? Like, if you're just constantly in the offensive zone, buzzing and attacking, you're probably eventually going to wind up getting some stuff that goes your way, whether it's a lucky bounce or a call like that. So that doesn't excuse what happened there. And I think Bruins fans certainly have a right to be very upset with it. But I think, like, in the grand scheme of how hockey's played and what's going on this postseason, it's also not really an aberration by any means.
Well, it's always that awkward thing where a huge component of the review is what was the call on the ice? Was it a goal on the ice or was it a no goal? And then they sort of work from there. So I wonder, if it's called off, if it's a no goal to start, what happens there in terms of the review and kind of how do they overturn it? I would assume they wouldn't. So it's difficult. But yeah, it's like I as much as Bruins fans will spit out their coffee, me saying this, you got to give props to Sam Bennett. Like, sure, the sucker punch was dirty, and the game four goal ends up obviously killing the Bruins and their momentum in the series. But the guy produces in the playoffs, and he finds a way to live around the edges, much like Brad Marchand usually does. And it's obviously ironic that that sucker punch was landed on Brad Marchand. So it's kind of par for the course in a lot of ways. Like Bennett always steps up in the playoffs, and the fact that he's only played four games in the postseason and has had such a big impact is pretty good evidence of that.
Well, regardless of who it happens to, we should be clear. Like, never want to see anyone get hurt. And also,
No.
I don't think under any circumstances we have to give it to Sam Bennett. At the same time, though, I see what you're saying in terms of, like,
Yeah.
the imprint on it. I do think it's interesting. Florida's approach does feel much different this year compared to last year, right? There's still certainly a highly chaotic team. There's a lot of shenanigans. I think particularly in some of these games that can get out of hand, they're going to be very willing to embrace, like, fully doubling down on all of it, regardless of if they're up big or if they're down big. The difference to me, though, is, like, last year they were clearly the underdog, right? Especially round one, they went into that matchup as, like, against a historically great regular season team, and they're down 3-1. And then the kind of narrative became like they're just trying to sort of upset the apple cart, right? And so they're, like, doing all of these crazy things to make teams uncomfortable and make them drag them into the deep end playing their game. This postseason, in both these series, in my opinion, and I think the sort of the betting markets reflect this, but anyone that watched the regular season would agree, they've went into both of them as heavy favorites, right? And so I think your approach in that way changes in terms of the way you sort of I guess, conduct yourself or the way like you're viewing your opponent and what you need to do to win as opposed to what happened last year, right? So I do think that's kind of interesting in terms of like just the change in approach and the difference between that, because I think that's sort of been reflected a little bit. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot to like about the team. I think what Barkov's been doing has been sensational, right? Because in previous like postseasons, like last year, he was playing such heavy defensive matchups where he wasn't necessarily producing much offensively himself. For a while, he got a reputation as being a player who wasn't very productive in the postseason. And whether it was game five against Tampa this year, where he could really just like emphatically shut the door on them in that clincher, or game two in this series where he had the 4-point game and which just dominated every single shift, he's been phenomenal in these big moments for this team. And it's kind of cool to see him sort of put it all together in that way and finally start getting some of the shine that he might not have been getting previously.
Yeah, it's tough to be Barkov sometimes as far as what's on your plate and what's left offensively. But to circle back on what you're saying before about the Panthers and what they bring to the table, I think that their secret weapon, or it's not very secret, but their sort of secret sauce is that they're just so versatile offensively. Like defensively, they're always going to give you a pretty high baseline, especially when Bobrovsky's playing well. Like I think they're always going to be okay there at worst. But then the offense, if the offense is humming, I mean, they're great with rebounds in terms of point shots, screens, and trying to pick up the garbage. They're great off the cycle, whether it's high or low, you know, forecheck, rush. Like they just bring so much to the table and they come at you in waves. So that's part of this too, part of the equation here too, where they're just a lot to handle.
They really are. My one final note in this series, and then we can move on to the next one, is I'm sure he's playing hard. And once they get eliminated, we're going to get this like laundry list of surgeries that he's going to go through. But Charlie McAvoy's play this postseason has been really eye-opening in terms of just how bad he's been. And similar to what we said about Amiro, who's obviously acquitting himself much better in his role, like his responsibility is just off the charts because he's playing so many minutes and doing so much. And I love Mason Lowry, but he's like playing with a rookie inexperienced defenseman and he's eating up all of these minutes. And so I think that's part of it. And I'm sure he's banged up, but whether it's kind of the puck handling and some of the turnovers he's made, I think that's probably more excusable because of all those things. I think his decision-making in how, and you saw it in game four, right? Where he makes that big hit on Sam Reinhart in the first shift, right? And that's great. Except you see, like he's constantly dragging himself out of the play to try to make these physical kind of quote unquote playoff hockey plays and throw hits. And oftentimes it winds up being to the detriment of his team where he's just out of position now. And the Panthers all of a sudden have a 3-on-2 or 2-on-1 or a break going up the ice. And he keeps doing it. It happened on the Barkov game winner where he kind of pinches it at center ice, tries to throw a hit, realizes he mistimed it. The puck gets past him. And then now all of a sudden he's wildly out of position. He's got a forward defending and Barkov's able to take the puck straight to the net and score. And you get a lot of praise once you land that big hit. And that's what you want to see from your defenseman in the postseason. But the other side of it, I think, has been happening far too frequently. And I think that's been like a major issue for them in terms of you look at his performance when he's been on the ice. And I think that's been a big reason why.
Well, I just looked it up while you're talking on Natural Stat Trick. He's delivered the most hits in the playoffs with 48, and he's been hit the most in the playoffs. He's taken the most at 65. So, I mean, that says a lot right there. It's like, there's too much physicality going on. Like, obviously there's a use for that. I'm sure within those hits delivered, there's some really meaningful ones that cause turnovers that disrupted a play. But I don't know if you ever want to be, especially a player as important as McAvoy is to everything that Boston does, I don't know if you ever want to be at the top of both of those categories at the same time.
Yeah, he's been on the ice for 5 of Florida's 8 5-on-5 goals in this series. And I think it's been a big issue for the Bruins. Any other notes on this series, or do you want to get into Rangers Hurricanes?
Yeah, let's do Rangers Hurricanes.
Let's do it. So there's been a lot of talk about New York's kind of special teams prowess this postseason and in this series in particular, right? And I think a lot of that is deserved. They've had 18 power play minutes in this series. They're up 4-0 in that time. They've been shorthanded for 26 and a half minutes or so, and it's tied 1-1 in that time. Actually, Carolina's only power play goal came as the game winner in game four, and they finally broke through. But the Rangers have gotten break after break, seemingly shorthanded against this Hurricanes power play, and it's been highly alarming from Carolina's perspective. So New York's dominated on the special teams. I think it's been a bit of a red herring for me in all of the coverage and analysis of this series, though, because for all of that and the shot counter being heavily in Carolina's favor in a lot of these games, you look and New York's either matching them or getting the better of them in scoring chances. And at 5-on-5 in this series, they're up 9-8. And so on the one hand, it's like that's a very close margin. And a lot of these games have been very close, and Carolina keeps losing these like tantalizing coin flip games seemingly every postseason. But also it's just kind of bizarre to me, I guess, that it's been framed so much through the lens of, wow, New York's kind of these like special teams merchants, and this is all they do. And then you look up and it's like, oh, they're getting more goals and scoring chances at 5-on-5 too. I think that's part of the reason why they're up 3-1 in this series.
Well, and before the series started, I looked up each team's 5-on-5 scoring, and obviously Carolina gets a ton of credit for how they control play at 5-on-5, and that happened in the regular season. It continues to happen in the playoffs to some extent. But New York scores a ton of 5-on-5 goals as well. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I believe both of them were top five teams and goals scored at 5-on-5. So it's not
No,
like we're off.
New York wasn't this season.
No?
No
I could be
chance.
wrong.
Yeah. No, maybe in the past. I'm not sure what their previous numbers were like. This year they weren't for sure, though. I think they like barely broke even in terms of 5-on-5 goal share.
But at the end of the day, they just operate in a different lane than Carolina, as far as they wait for the quality opportunity versus versus shooting for quantity, and have the high-end finishers to actually convert on those. So, like, I don't know. It's kind of one of those things where when the Rangers goal scorers are feeling it, they can be super dangerous in any situation. I mean, we even saw it, like you mentioned, they got a shorthanded goal, Kreider there. And 5-on-5, they've done all right in the series. So if the power play is humming and, they're getting enough good looks at 5-on-5, they should be fine.
Well, the power play is humming. The penalty kill has been really good all year, and I think that's really important when you're going to be a top power play to also have a penalty kill that can hold its own, because you're going to get into some game management situations where sometimes if you're getting power plays yourself, you're also going to have to kill some on the other end, and they've been able to do that. Yeah, they were 21st in 5-on-5 scoring this year,
Oh,
tied with the
okay.
Ottawa
I don't know where I got
Senators.
that from. My bad.
Listen, we're going to praise the Rangers here. I mean, they're up 3-1. They're playing really well, but
Pump
let's not
the
go
brakes
too
here.
far. No, but I do think, and you've seen it in the series, where the Hurricanes obviously have a phenomenal defensive structure and they don't really give up much, but I think it's a testament to the way the Rangers play and also how they've kind of forced Carolina a bit out of its comfort zone because of this accumulation of like how they're turning scoring shots and the scoring chances into goals. The Carolina's maybe playing a bit out of their element. And what's happened is New York's creating a bunch of odd man rushes, even at 5-on-5, right? Where they might not have shots for a couple minutes, and then all of a sudden you look up and it's a 2-on-1. And it's not even necessarily just one line. It seems like the third line is just as likely to have that opportunity as the first or second line. It's kind of been a team concept, consistent throughout for them. So I think what they've done offensively to Carolina's vaunted defensive structure is really impressive. I think what they've done at 5-on-5 has been, underreported, I guess, in this series. And so it's interesting. It's going to be very tight, I'm sure. Game five is playing tonight. It's going to be the same as it's been all series, but I think there's a lot going on there. And the one final kind of point I had on this was I had Kevin Woodley on last week, and we were talking about Igor Shesterkin and how good he is with his pads and kind of blocking off the lower part of the net, and how that can cause frustrations to Carolina because of how they typically like to shoot and attack. And you actually saw it in game four, where Stephen Nason scores off a rebound. And what he does is he's coming through the slot and he actually finally lifts the puck on the rebound, and it winds up getting by Shesterkin. And a lot of these rebounds that we get frustrated with by them are sort of quick attempts where they're just like poking at the puck and sweeping it towards the goalie. And that just doesn't really work against Shesterkin. And so it's a bit counterintuitive, because I think you're generally trained, once you get that rebound, to quickly get it back on net before the goalie can recover into position, right? But I think in this case, what Woodley was saying, and I think it's bang on, is they almost need to retrain themselves to take a second to dust the puck off and try to pick a spot in the net as opposed to just kind of blindly throwing it back. And it might sometimes lead to a New York defender recovering in time and preventing a rebound, or them missing the net and it leaving the zone and kind of killing their cycle opportunity. But those are some of the risks that I think they need to take offensively if they actually want to score. And you look at all the goals they scored in game four, where they finally broke through and scored four goals for the first time against Shesterkin in forever. And all of them were unlifted pucks that were very well executed and not just kind of randomly thrown on net, right? So I think that's going to be a big key for them moving forward.
Someone's listening to Woodley's takes here.
Well, I think everyone should.
The Hurricanes organization.
Yeah.
No, I think that was an astute take at the time, and it's looked pretty good now. On the side of Carolina, I mean, Gensel's the only guy with multiple goals in this series for them. Only guy with double digit high danger attempts. He's got 15. He's exactly what Carolina's needed, and he's kind of carried his load. So it's a little unfortunate in that sense from Carolina's perspective, where you go out, you make this big splash, and things are going well individually with Gensel. But for whatever reason, in the second round, you just can't seem to get over the hump. And I realize it's been 4-1 goal games. You know, two of them have gone to OT. It's very much a coin flip series in a lot of ways. Tightly contested, really quite an entertaining series. Good goaltending on both ends. But that's got to be a little frustrating, where I guess you'd rather have it than Gensel not playing well. But there's something about that where it's like, okay, it seems like Carolina made the right choice here at the deadline. They finally put their chips in. But then for whatever reason, this second round is really giving them problems overall.
No, well, I it's frustrating because it kind of, on the surface, all the same stuff appears to be happening again. But listen, like you and I have done shows here the past couple of seasons. I've done plenty of my takes against the Hurricanes where it's like, I'm very critical of their offensive approach. I think what we're seeing right now, though, while it is frustrating, is kind of heartening in a way, because it actually, I think, does reinforce everything we've been saying. And the reason why I point that out is while they're getting the shot volume, but not necessarily winning the scoring chances, I don't think it's the case of what it's been in the previous years, where it was their own undoing, where like they just were so stubborn in their ways and it cost them. And I don't think it's as simple as, well, they should just try to create more scoring chances, because I actually do think they are trying to do that by design this year, right? We documented it throughout the second half of the year, how they started playing differently. They brought in Jake Gensel, who certainly helped that. And you look in this series, you noted it. He's got 3 goals, 2 assists. I've got him down for 17 scoring chances taken and 8 created. Like, he's easily leading the series in both those categories. And they essentially, like, I think what it's reinforced is they're on the right track and they actually just need more of him. Like, unfortunately, it's easier said than done because he's a phenomenal player and it's hard to find guys like him. But I do think it does reinforce that idea that it's like, this is the way, the direction they need to go in as a team. Now, it's tricky because they're trying to do it in a very short, condensed period of time. And they're going up against the Rangers team who, this is essentially their ethos. Like, they've internalized it and they've done it and mastered it over the years. And so it's tricky for Carolina to all of a sudden become that team. But I do think that's kind of what's going on here. So I'm actually taking the other view of like his performance in it and how he's looked and what it's meant to them. I think it reinforces that this is what they need more of, as opposed to, oh man, we paid for this rental and we're actually not getting the job done anyways and we made a mistake.
Well, for sure. Can we talk about Lafreniere?
And how absolutely. He's I mean, Lafreniere for sure.
He's been awesome. Very assertive, very confident. Like, one word that comes to mind when I watch him right now, and I understand he's had a breakout season, this isn't happening overnight, but he seems so comfortable and kind of he's found a role in the NHL. He's found a way to impact the game in his own unique way. And, all you know, 4 goals, all of them in the second round, 10 points in 10 games. He's finishing in tight. He's finishing off the rush. I thought Harnarayan Singh is a great play-by-play guy, and I think he's actually been so good for this series on Sportsnet. Because he really like rise his call really is suited for playoff hockey. But he called that bang shot on Anderson a fortuitous goal. And I thought that it was actually the opposite. I thought that it was played perfectly by Lafreniere, and that he That was actually a lot of skill. There was a little luck involved in that, and I thought it was perhaps misplayed by Anderson, but still, he knew, the shooter there knew exactly what he was doing. And again, just a guy dialed in, and someone who's toe dragging and just trying everything in his tool bag, and most of it's working.
Well, on the goal they scored on the rush goal, you're kind of referenced there in game three, the big one was such a cool goal because it involved everyone on that line that's been so good all year and actually like perfectly demonstrated why they've been so effective. And it was like Trocheck making this little puck protection play to get the puck to Panarin, Panarin making a great pass off the rush, and then Lafreniere just hammering it home. And so you kind of saw all the little steps and nuances to it, and it resulted in a goal. And that's always cool to see. John, let's take our break here, and then when we come back, we'll keep going. We'll jump around and cover some other series as well. You're listening to the Hockey PDOcast streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network. All right, we're back here with John Mattis on the PDOcast. John, we did the two East series. Let's talk a little bit about the West ones and cover them as well, and kind of what happened over the weekend. I would start with Stars Avs because I love this series so much and everything about it. And every game has been so entertaining. Even in game three, where it was a bit kind of slower paced, fewer goals, just the chess match between these two teams and how they stack up against each other and sort of the feeling out process. But then when you see them at their absolute best, it's so fun to watch. There's so much to unpack there. What are you seeing from this one? What are you enjoying? Give me some stuff on Stars Avs.
Well, I feel like we're seeing the best of Cale Makar in a lot of instances here, whereas in the regular season, he's still a Norris finalist. The bar is very high. So when he's quote unquote struggling or not having a fantastic year, he still registers very highly. But just in this series, like Miro's a fantastic player, but like I just don't see appear on Dallas's back end. And you can go across the league and good luck finding too many players that stack up against Makar when he's really on his game. So that's really stuck out. And just Colorado's star power, when like their fastball is just super dangerous, when they're all sort of firing on all cylinders, not to use too many cliches here. I just feel like they're just unbeatable. It's just a matter of can they bottle that enough throughout a series? That's always the big question mark with them.
Well, they were incredibly frustrated in game three because I thought they came out really strong. They were certainly, I think they took games one and two to heart in terms of how they fell behind early and didn't want to replicate that. And so they were really throwing everything they could at the Stars. And I thought Jake Ottinger was phenomenal at the start. But as that game went along, you sort of saw Dallas's structure. And I'm with you on the one hand where it's like individually, you're not really going to be able to match it. But from a team perspective, I do think this is why this is such a fascinating matchup, because the Stars entered the third period up 2-1, and they just proceed to do something to the Avs, which I think is almost, I can't really recall seeing it very much. I know like Seattle gave them some issues last year, but that was such a shell of what Colorado is right now and has been in the past offensively. They proceeded to hold Colorado to zero scoring chances in the entire third period of game three. And that was while defending that lead. That was only the second time all postseason, I've tracked every single game so far, that that's happened. The first one was Florida doing it to Boston in game one, or sorry, game three, period one, the night before. So we got them back to back, but that was just a defensive masterclass. And so I thought that was incredibly notable to me. I know that Tanev got finally beaten by Nathan MacKinnon off that little move that he hit him with the crossover. If you give him that much space into the zone, he's going to get you. Got past him, Mikko Rantanen, and banged home the rebound. But then you saw later on in that game, the most underrated part of Tanev's game, I think, is his breakout ability in terms of not necessarily, always doing the zone exits himself. Usually it's making life easier for his partner by absorbing a forechecker and then getting it up the ice to him. In this one, that's exactly what you saw, where he takes a big hit and he knows he's in the train tracks and he's going to get hit, but he makes a play up the ice. It springs that 3-on-2. They wind up executing the rush to perfection, and that wound up being the game winner. And so Yeah, that really stood out to me, just the team performance in general. And now we're going to game four tonight, and I think it's going to be another really fun one. And I fully expect Colorado to, have internalized what happened as that game went along and make adjustments. We'll see. Jonathan Drouin might even come back, so I think that's going to be a huge boost for them offensively. But yeah, I'm fully expecting, like, we've seen a lot of back and forth in this series so far, and I imagine that'll be the case the rest of the way.
Yeah, this is going seven games, right? Like, let's not get ourselves here. It sure seems like it. And just to circle back a bit on Tanev, it's almost like we as, and I use the we as, just the hockey world, almost did him a disservice by focusing on the shot blocking and the shutdown ability over the years, where, this breakout ability, this first pass, has been there for a long time. And, obviously some people have noticed it, some people have focused on it, but it's kind of funny how that works out. And from a big picture perspective, you get labeled as one type of player, and we just assume you can't do the other things that, say, an offensive defenseman excels at. But Tanev has really found a way to, I guess, toe the line of being part of the breakout but not leading it, as you mentioned, or sorry, not rushing the puck out himself, or being sort of that guy who stirs the drink on the transition. But he's a key cog of it. So. And the fact that he's doing it at this age, like, is really impressive. There's a lot of guys who take a beating like he has over his career that really tail off in the back half of their 30s. And I think he's like 34, so I guess he's not quite there. But still, he has a lot of miles on him, and he's still super effective.
I will say one of my, we're just bringing up things that we've kind of noticed and want to alert listeners to when they're watching these games. Might not see it in game four. We'll see. He doesn't do it necessarily every time. But if Evgeny Dodonov, countless times this season, has either tried or successfully completed a zone entry with his back turned to the play, he's like backing into the zone and doing so sometimes not even like to protect the puck, just doing it. Just
Just for
skating
fun.
backwards and just kind of going in the zone. And I was like, oh my God, it's the most like random niche thing. But if you see that, I want you to do the Leo DiCaprio meme where you're pointing at your TV and being like, there we go. I saw it. I did have a question here on the Discord, and we should shout out the Discord and everyone in there. And if you're not in there yet somehow and you're listening to this, invite link is in the show notes. Please join us. Robu says, how does Dallas deal with Joe Pavelski right now? Seems like he's slowing any line he's on. Ben, Johnson, Pavelski have an 8.3 expected goal share at 5-on-5 in this series against Colorado. Against Vegas, Pavelski struggled playing with Hintz and Robertson, and now that they're not playing with him, they're doing well with Stankoven instead. Could slash should they move Pavelski even further down the lineup? Now, it's tricky because I think they sort of acknowledged how much he was struggling by splitting that lineup, and they have looked significantly better with Stankoven doing all the Logan Stankoven stuff and helping put them in position to succeed. Unfortunately, now it's sort of like nuking their best offensive player in Wyatt Johnston as a result. And it's tricky for a coach because, on the one hand, I commend Pete DeBoer for being willing to embrace data and information and then make lineup decisions accordingly. Yeah, this is such like a respected veteran player that's a huge part of your team. And it's just really tough to like move them down even further. And you've got that third line they've been using that's much more of a rush line already. So then I think the only way you could even proceed with a further move down would be like moving him down to the fourth line and potentially using Dodonov instead, who has played really well offensively so far. So maybe that's an option. But yeah, it's a pretty extreme measure, regardless of how bad it's been and how poor the results are, for a coach like on the fly like this to make that sort of a change, considering like what that represents, I guess, to the team.
Yeah, the stakes are so high, right? That you don't want to rock the boat too hard with a veteran. But I don't know. Pavelski, from my interactions with him, from what you hear about him, he seems like the guy that would be self-aware enough to go, I don't have it right now. It's best for the team if I slot further down the lineup. I could be wrong, but he certainly strikes me as someone that, as competitive as he is, as much as he believes in himself, probably knows that things have kind of fallen off a cliff here. And they kind of have, right? Like, it's been pretty ugly in the playoffs. And I
It's,
wouldn't say we saw all those signs in the regular season. We saw some of them, but
yeah.
it's been bad.
I mean, I'm kind of watching through my fingers right now. And that really bums me out because I've long loved his game and he was so effective up until very recently, right? Even as you said, like, I think towards the latter stages of the regular season, he kind of started to show some signs of losing his efficiency, but he was still productive. And it still wasn't one of those things where even if he's not at his best, you're like sad every time you see him out there. But in this series, like he botches the breakaway in game one or two. I think it was game two, game three. He falls trying to forecheck Jack Johnson. Then Cale Makar just abuses him on the breakout and makes him fall again behind the net. He had another botched breakaway where like it seemed like he was alone, and then all of a sudden the puck bounced on him and he looked like he was skating in quicksand and couldn't get up the ice. And yeah, it's tough because like I don't want to speak too poorly on him just because he's such a respected player and I've loved him for so long, but also it's just really, really tough to watch right now. And I'm not sure if it's just an age thing. I'm sure he's banged up as well. Also, with his skill set, particularly around the net, if he's able to get in those positions, you'd like to think he will still find a way to get on the score sheet and make an impact, even though he hasn't yet so far this postseason. But right now, I know they're up 2-1 and they've played well in this series, but we talk about how like small the margins are in the postseason, and you know Colorado's certainly going to give a pushback here. And I think at some point, if this continues, they will have to make an extreme decision like that and move him down the lineup, just because I mean they're one of the few teams in the league that is actually like equipped enough with enough players to do that and not it not you know be really tough to argue with, just because they have so many other options they could play there instead.
Yeah, and this ties into what we were saying about Tanev. Like, Pavelski's been almost an anomaly as far as him having his best seasons in his 30s. I mean, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but there's been some like outlier years as he's edged towards 40. And I don't know, maybe it's an injury. If that's the case, certainly demote him because, you know, there's at least a reason to demote him, like that he's limited. But either way, I think Dodonov, your idea of putting Dodonov up there with Johnston and Benn makes a ton of sense. And you know, between Steele, Smith, and Pavelski, maybe he can create some havoc and try to get Pavelski in front of goalies for those tips, what he's a master of.
Okay, let's close out here today with some Canucks Oilers. We saw the Canucks take game three on Sunday night. What are your kind of feelings on this series? Because it's certainly been hotly contested, and we saw things kind of blow up after the game as well. We'll see what happens with the Carson Soucy hearing. But it's been a fascinating series because we're sort of seeing, I guess, the reasons why we're so high on the Oilers, and also the sort of the red flags in terms of the CeCe Nurse pairing, kind of the lack of depth, how much they have to, especially when they're playing like Draisaitl and McDavid are playing so well together with Hyman, and that's great. But now they're getting to this point where I think Chris Knobloch even acknowledged after the game they're using them way too much and they're not getting depth scoring. And so it causes other concerns throughout the lineup. So yeah, I don't know. What are your takes on the series?
Well, I know it's not a new development, but the CeCe Nurse pairing is, I feel like it has to be broken up at this point as far, and I know there's not a ton of good options as far as alternatives, but it's gotten to the point where if I'm Chris Knobloch, I've got to be exploring every single option. I mean, it's ugly out there, and I don't really know if it becomes, you know, Ekholm and Bouchard, who are so good together, get split up just out of necessity here because you're losing those Nurse CeCe minutes at such a lopsided to such a lopsided extent that it's, you know, it could cave them. It could ruin the series for them.
It could. They are down 5-1 in 45, 5-1-5 minutes with those guys on the ice so far through three games. They're up 4-2 in the other
Man,
100
that's
minutes.
bad.
So it's tough. I will say, so the past two games after Draisaitl was banged up in game one, right? We've seen them go pretty much full time with that loaded up top line. And they've played 36 minutes or so together at 5-on-5. They're absolutely crushing in that time. But we're getting into a point where like McDavid's playing nearly 30 minutes, Draisaitl's playing 28, 29. And so that's something to monitor as the series continues. And I wanted to shout out, despite the fact that they're controlling so much territorially, they're getting shots, they're getting chances, they're getting expected goals, all that. McDavid's played 33 and a half minutes at 5-on-5 in the series so far versus JT Miller head to head. And the goals are 1-0 Vancouver in that time. And so I wanted to shout out JT Miller, a player whose performance I've been critical of in past years, because I felt like despite the talent and despite his reputation and the way he was talked about, I felt like the attention to detail sometimes, particularly off the puck, wasn't there. And then you'd get to the point where he would like lash out and yell at a teammate, and people would be like, "Oh, he's so fiery! What a competitor!" It's like, all right, well, maybe that didn't need to happen. now you're seeing on this team that's actually competing and the effort he's putting in and how well he's playing both on and off the puck, where he's creating so much offensively. He was their entire offensive engine in round one against Nashville. Any offense they created, albeit a very limited amount, was directly responsible because of his play. And then now in this series, he still got the goal. He got, I think he has four primary assists, but he also is kind of excelling in this head-to-head defensive assignment. And so that's cool because it's an extreme amount of effort. And so far he's checking all the boxes.
Yeah. He's such an interesting player. You mentioned the fieriness. You know, he's proven season after season that he can put up points, and in a vacuum, good defensive player when you watch, you know, certain clips, but then, you know, you watch others and you question what's going through his head. And, you know, obviously a certain type of personality, right? Like, let's face it, there's probably only one JT Miller in the NHL as far as what he brings to the table in that respect. I mean, you got to give props to what Vancouver's done without Demko. I mean, this it was easy to, or could have been easy to write them off after their starter goes down, a guy who had a Vezina caliber season, and to be in the spot that they are in the second round. I think that alone, you know, just kind of zooming out for a second, is one, a credit to Rick Tocchet and his system, and two, a credit to just the players hunkering down and the goaltending holding up.
Yeah, especially when the guy on the other end of the ice has a sub 800 save percentage in the series. It's really really highlighting that. Yeah, on the Miller note, I said one goal, four primary assists. Only Quinn Hughes has played more than him on the Canucks in this series, and he hasn't taken a single penalty in that time as well, despite going head to head with McDavid. So yeah, it's been a phenomenal effort. We will see. The reason why I kind of noted, you know, the Soucy storyline here is because they've been using, in those minutes against McDavid, they've been using him and Myers in that shutdown pair, right? Where I think they've played nearly twice as much as any other defense pair against McDavid. And if he's out, I'm curious to see what they'll do, because I don't, as well as Zadorov's played this postseason, I don't think Rick Tocchet necessarily wants to play him and Myers together, because that's very chaotic and the results reflected as much when they played together in the regular season after Zadorov was acquired. So we'll see what happens with that, because obviously if Susie's out, that leaves a big hole. And then how do you fit that against McDavid? So a lot to unpack there. But yeah, it was interesting because we also saw in game three where the numbers were heavily skewed in Edmonton's favor, and they certainly hit the post a couple times. And Shelov's made that sort of last second play off the goal line where he gloved the puck and stopped it from going in. So the Edmonton did get their opportunities, and I don't want to make it sound like they didn't. At the same time, though, especially in that third period, you're able to see why Vancouver has been so good at protecting leads this season. And like when they're able to just kind of get in their structure and not even worry at all about what they're going to do offensively and essentially just kind of pack the paint and be disciplined, it's really tough to break through that, right? Edmonton had that one power play late, and like this is to the absolute extreme, and it was kind of funny, but like Tyler Myers is just on one knee, essentially just crouching down, blocking the cross ice pass. And he's just like down on one knee for what felt like nearly the entire power play. And it's like, all right, at this point, like, yes, that does not mean that probably Evan Bouchard or someone will have an open shot, but it's going to be from a position on the ice where at least you kind of have to pick your poison and live with it, as opposed to giving Edmonton what they were doing at LA pretty much all series. So in that sense, it's kind of showed it, not that the shot totals will reflect it, but it's kind of also shown why they've been so successful defensively this year. And I think why they're able to plug in their third string goalie and not to take anything away from him, but get the performance they have from him so far.
Well, it can be a dangerous way to live if you're hunkering down after you gain a lead in the regular season. I think if you kind of get into that Scorefex trap of just, okay, we have a lead, now we're playing really defensive, we're going to dump and chase, and that's the extent of our game, and we're going to hope for the best. I think generally not a great idea, but in these cases, in these small samples of you're just trying to win the next game and you're trying to fight tooth and nail for every puck, it makes sense, especially because now they have such a large sample size of Tocchet's, you know, MO or DNA on this team, that there's got to be a lot of confidence there where it's like, okay, at some point we're all just going to become goalies out there. We're just going to stand in front of shots and hope for the best in terms of the bounces off that. And hey, I honestly I can't argue with it given the results so far, and especially with a guy like McDavid and a guy like Draisaitl on the other end, where if you do try to go tit for tat, sometimes that can really blow up for your, in your face if you're not careful. So interesting strategy, one I wouldn't recommend to every single team in the league, but I think that the Canucks have it figured out.
Certainly. All right, John, let's get out of here and let's get this thing out there so people can listen to it before these games start here tonight on Monday. I'll let you plug some stuff on the way out. What do you have going on right now?
Yeah, sure. Just covering the playoffs, and then I'll start writing some stories about the draft and whatnot, free agency. So your best bet for following my work is to just follow me on Twitter, and I tweet out my links, retweet my links all the time. It's MATISZJOHN, my last name, first name, no underscore, no space, no nothing. And yeah, download the Score app, and those are my two plugs.
Awesome, buddy. We'll keep up the great work. We'll have you on again soon. Pop into the Discord and join us. John's in there as well, if you're not already, and you can get in questions for us in the future as well, and just be part of the conversation every night while we're watching these games. And smash the 5-star button as well, while you're out there helping us out, wherever you listen. Greatly appreciated. Thank you to everyone for listening to us. And that's all for today. We'll be back soon with plenty more here of the Hockey PDOcast streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network.